Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today's guest is Kate Kenny. Kate is Professor of Business and Society at Galway University, NUIG Galway. She has held research fellowships at Harvard and Cambridge universities, and her research focuses on organizational studies, and in particular, political and psychosocial approaches. Kate's been researching whistleblowing since 2010. She's written two books on the subject. She's had articles in the FT and the Irish Times, The Guardian, and her work's been cited in UK and Irish parliaments and used in European policy documents. She's an expert in the field, and I'm keen to ask her some questions about whistleblowing. Kate, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Simon. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
I'm really delighted to have you. We've done some reading groups together. I've been interested in your work for a long time, so I'm really pleased to have you here. Tell us what got you interested in whistleblowing in the first place, Kate.
I think that, you know, when you talk to a lot of academics, they're often drawn to research maybe things in their own area of life that not that they struggle with, but that have a personal curiosity. And I'm always in awe of people who manage to, when they see things that they don't agree with, things that are wrong, to actually speak up about it, even when it goes against the norms of the group, which, as we know, as psychosocial researchers, can be really compelling. It's a general awe of the topic, I have to tell you, Simon.
And you've done a lot of research. You've been talking to people, interviewing people. What is it about whistleblowing which stands out for you? Kind of let's get some core thoughts about whistleblowing.
Yeah, sure. I mean, because this is a kind of, I'm aware of the topic of the podcast and maybe the areas your readers or your listeners rather are interested in. So I think, you know, one way into this is when we think and talk about whistleblowing, even in the media when you read about it, or even when you read research on it, we tend to think about individuals who speak up. We think about, think of a whistleblower that pops into your head that you might have read about in the news recently. We tend to think of these as isolated, autonomous people acting alone. They often get pulled into stereotypes. Are they a hero or are they a traitor? And these stereotypes, they play out in the media. They play out actually in academic research as well. You know, back in the 80s and parts of the 90s, whistleblowing is talked about in quite a pejorative way, quite a negative way by management and organization literature. And on the other side, it's often celebrated as this kind of heroic individual act. I mean, even when Edward Snowden, I don't know if you recall, when he came forward with his disclosures about national the NSA, when his story was covered, NBC, for example, in the US, they quickly followed it up with a poll for the viewers. Is he a hero or is he a traitor? Vote now, in. This is kind of common. And so this is incredibly problematic for a number of reasons. It's a real problem. First of all, you know, what I found, we've been researching, interviewing people who've spoken out for 10 years at this stage, and there's very few resources to help people, especially if they've been excluded from their organization and they're trying to seek work or financial help. There's very little out there. And I think it's because we stereotype people like, oh, well, you know, they're these extraordinary characters. Even if they're extraordinary, courageous characters, they're still extraordinary. Why would they need help? So, you know, there's not much help. And I think that's a negative thing from that stereotyping. And I think the other thing is, it ignores the problem, you know, and this is something that we'd be familiar with. I mean, even I think of the French philosopher Michel Foucault when he talks about individualism in society. And, you know, his point is that when we focus on the self, when we overly focus on the individual, we tend to ignore structures of power. We tend to ignore attempts at domination and oppression because we're so busy, you know, looking at and figuring out the individual. And we tend to overlook the potential for collective action. So I guess for all those reasons, I was thinking, okay, we look at these individuals, but there is more going on. And actually a psychosocial perspective can kind of tell us a little bit more about that, deepen our understanding, if that makes sense.
That's very important. Yeah. I mean, I've read some of your work on this, and that's what attracted me to it. It's so important because I've been in a lot of situations where I'm a coach and I've worked in the health sector and I've been around whistleblowers and on a minor scale, not Edward Snowden style, but it's very interesting what happens to them and how they feel so persecuted, how the system does persecute them in a sense.
Yeah, for sure.
The ambivalence of their colleagues. It's always interesting to me, the ambivalence of their colleagues who may know that they're right, but can put them in a very punitive situation. Often there's a huge ambivalence in people around whistleblowers, isn't there? What is your research
about
that? Well,
there is. I mean, yes, I think that organizations, as we know, they're brilliant things in many ways, aren't they? I mean, this is your bread and butter and many of your listeners, they're fabulous. Organizations enable us to do really complex things at great scale by people working together. They enable us to save lives, their hospitals, their educate populations. Yeah. At the same time, as we know, organizations, the very features of them that enable those things to happen, the rationality within, or the supposed rationality in some cases, the rules, the hierarchies, these can create anxiety, huge anxiety, because of the way responsibility is often delegated without power to help someone achieve the job they've been assigned to do, or the distance between different people in different ranks in the hierarchy. All these things can create anxiety. And I think, you know, when in ordinary employees, we often, just by dint of being human, the superego comes to play here, that we often project certain feelings onto the organizations that we work for. We project and we identify maybe with them sometimes in our careers, maybe too strongly, or with our professions.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what happens when a whistleblower emerges that is seen to, even if we understand what they're doing is correct, I think many people feel threatened and defense mechanisms can kick in. And then, you know, in these sorts of cases, because these people are often, for reasons I spoke about, alone, isolated, it's quite easy to blame, to scapegoat, to vilify these people, even where it goes against the fact that we understand what they're saying is right. You know, I mean, for those who are interested in this area, Professor Fred Alford of Maryland University wrote a great book. I'm looking for it here on my shelf. It's got some fish swimming backwards. But Fred Alford's book, From Broken Lives and Organizational Power. And he really explains that, you know, and he's saying you can tell a lot about those dynamics of organizations, about the passion by which many people will protect the boundaries of an organization. We can tell a lot about that by what happens to the whistleblowers who threaten those boundaries. So, you know, I think it's really interesting. And obviously, this is the kind of the psychoanalytic or psychosocial perspective that he brings to bear on this. And I think it's that sort of type of work that I'm interested in, as are a number of colleagues that I would work with.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience, it's sort of a both and, isn't it? That there is an individual sensibility. There is a valency for carrying certain things. So you'll often get a whistleblower who will be a strong character or will have a strong moral sense and feel a moral duty to speak out. But they also act on behalf of the group. It's like group relations teaches us kind of how often a group can mobilize us, that the whole group projects into one person and they speak on behalf of the group and they may get praised for it or they may get vilified for it. But
that's true.
Act in a social group, don't we?
Yeah, we do. And I mean, it's ambivalent, of course, as well, because I mean, where I think one of the things I was researching for a book recently, interviewing people across the world in financial sector whistleblowing, trying to understand the various dynamics at play, but also what was helping people. And that group identification can occur obviously outside of the organization too. So where people were finding themselves isolated and vilified, it was the support and recognition, particularly recognition of this as a valid, as a celebrated subject position by supporters, by other whistleblowers, by certain elements of the media that could really help people to survive, and not just materially survive, if you like, but survive from a psychological perspective, because being offered this sort of valid position, being offered this sense of self that is not the vilified one, is really helpful for people, because I think one of the things psychosocial perspectives can show us is we can internalize norms that exclude us, you know. So, you know, women can internalize patriarchal norms and come to sort of project those inwards, as we know, the same with other groups that might be externalized or vilified or excluded in society. You know, it's a myth that people who are members of those groups will not internalize that. And what you often find, and with Professor Mariana Fataki, you've been working on this, we often find that from the perspective of the whistleblower, the violence of exclusion, particularly if they're in the kind of organization that is excluding them, this can be something that people take in upon themselves, and it exacerbates it as a form of violence, this aspect of mental health. Because practically speaking, it's not uncommon for, especially increasingly so, for if somebody is speaking out and they are in a dispute with their organization, in the early stages, for them to be sent to psychiatric evaluations, sometimes that are paid for by the organization themselves, and then sometimes that are used to discredit the veracity of their claims, to say this person is not legitimate. But I just want to make it clear, actually, that what we do know is that not every whistleblower is retaliated against, not at all. I think statistics are pretty stable on this. You're talking about 1 in 5 people who speaks out about relatively serious wrongdoing might encounter some form of retaliation. So that's 4 out of 5 that don't, you know, and some people are often, it benefits the career. But it's still, when those 1 out of 5, when that 20% is retaliated against, sometimes it can be quite serious and it can have really negative effects. So that's why this area of research has emerged. So just to make the point clearly that not every whistleblower, not every person who speaks out about something falls into this position.
No, I mean, those who do, they can suffer huge kind of self-doubt and become very isolated. You're often excluded from work. You're often kind of put on gardening leave or something, and you're left at home to kind of ruminate over what you've done.
True.
But the do you notice things in different industries? I don't know. I was thinking about the airline industry and how there was a culture in the airline industry of covering up mistakes, and then they had a huge transformation, and they began to really encourage, I guess it's whistleblowing about mistakes, about errors.
Absolutely.
And then that got taken into the health service because they realized the same thing was happening in the health service. People would cover up mistakes together. Do you notice different industries or sectors kind of act differently?
Well, yes. And I mean, the airline industry is often brought up. And I think one of the things about that, when they kind of made it a cultural feature, that instead of, you know, when organizations report on X number of disclosures of wrongdoing every year, you know, tell the shareholders or tell in their annual report, we've had 100 disclosures of wrongdoing. And in many industries, that's seen as, oh my gosh, that's evidence of problems. But the airline industry, because of this cultural turnaround some years ago, decided that actually this was a target, that any healthy organization, for reasons we know, any healthy organization is going to have dysfunctions, there's going to be problems emerge. And if you're not reporting them, and if your numbers are low, it's more a sign that you're hiding that, you know, because that is the absolute nature. Yeah. So I think that was really good. And the thing about the airline industry is a number of otherwise competing organizations and firms all agreed to do it at the same time, which is the only way that's going to work. Otherwise, your competitor is saying, oh, look how corrupt these people are because of all these disclosures. So that was one thing. Health, to a certain extent, I mean, certainly we look at the NHS in the UK, and they've had really well described problems with people who have disclosed information. We look at the Francis report, and there's been significant institutional moves to address that by various ways of, I think, freedom to speak up and encouraging staff to come forward and protecting those that do. However, health is a really complex area. We wrote with Professor Fataki, we wrote about this in The Conversation at the outbreak of COVID. Obviously, what COVID showed us many, many things, as we know now. But what that pandemic showed was that you had doctors and nurses from the start trying to speak up about various aspects. Obviously, the first whistleblower to do with the pandemic was a Chinese doctor who sadly passed away. And he was trying to explain to colleagues and to others on social media that we have this virus now, and we thought it was only problematic for animals, and now it's passing to humans. And he was vilified and punished for sharing that information.
Yes.
But since then, we had doctors and nurses in the early year or the early months of the pandemic speaking out about lack of PPE, about other sorts of things. But it really revealed other structural features of certain healthcare systems. For example, in the UK, it was pretty clear early on that continued defunding of the reserves of PPE was what was making the health system in the UK was unable to cope with this because of, and this was to do with market forces. So this was to do with a particular approach to efficiency, a particular approach to balancing the books, which, you know, as many argue, is not appropriate in healthcare settings. I think the US was also experiencing this. So we had doctors and nurses speaking out, whistleblowing about this. But as the editor of The Lancet medical journal said, you know, these people are getting warned about speaking out. These people are getting punished for speaking out, these medics. And so it's often where a system is creaking at the seams is where you'll find individual whistleblowers who it's really a position of last resort to go public. It's really a kind of an extreme, the bit where the system is failing, because 90% of whistleblowers do try to speak up internally first. You know, nobody chooses to go externally. You just need 5 seconds on a search engine to find out how difficult a situation you can find yourself in. So sure. I think that's one of the things. So different industries play out in different ways. There's been other aspects of the pandemic that I could talk about that have shown, for example, there was a huge case at Amazon I can tell you about. So Amazon workers worldwide have been speaking out since March 2020 about health and safety issues. And the interesting thing there is, so there was one individual in particular who was his case was described in the Washington Post and other newspapers. And he was a manager in, I think it was a Brooklyn warehouse, managing 70 staff. And there were real problems with the cleaning, the facilities after outbreaks of COVID-19, no sick pay, other aspects that he was really, really worried. The people he was managing, they were parents, they were caring for family members, and they were being exposed in this way, and tried to speak up and was not given an audience, and then was fired from his job. And in fact, what happened was a senior executive was reported in the Washington Post, a senior Amazon executive, describing this case at board level. So at very senior level, they were discussing, well, what are we going to do about this whistleblower? Now he's in the media and this, you know, how are we going to respond? Yeah. And the response of, I think it was reported of one of the senior legal advisors, the implicit statement was, look, because of who he is, he's black, he's a person of color, he won't be taken seriously, we'll be listened to, he won't be reaching an audience. And so it was reported as a real case of quite extreme racism at the most senior level. And this was one individual, but since then, Amazon warehouse workers all over the world have collectivized and been speaking out about ordinary workers being exposed to problems and struggling to get their rights through COVID-19. So it's all been in the newspapers. But what we're seeing there is it's not just whistleblowing doesn't happen in a vacuum. The ground by which someone can speak up, you know, the infrastructure that's available to any of us to speak up is very much based on our own situation in terms of how we are at work, the security of the work that we're in, and other aspects to do with gender, to do with race, to do with class. All of those structure and influence who gets to speak up in a particular area. So I think the pandemic has shown us a number of different things.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really, really useful you bringing it back to structural issues. Is there a pattern of gender, race, marginalized communities speaking up more or speaking up less because they feel powerless or empowered? Is there any patterns you found, or is it very contextual and local specific?
No, I think so. It's always hard. One of the hardest things, as you can imagine, is to study who's not speaking out, because how can you find who's not speaking out? However, actually, we can approach it, you know, for this conversation, we can approach it in kind of oblique way. So one of the big areas across Europe is the outbreaks clusters of COVID-19 in meat factory plants, for example. And certainly in Ireland, and I believe in the UK as well, there's a high proportion of employees without workers' rights because maybe they've come from other countries and do not have full citizenship status, and so are in precarious positions anyway. So what we're seeing is significant outbreaks and nothing, no speaking up about it, because you know, in order to speak up, you kind of have to depend upon the fact that you have some sort of workers' rights that are going to support you in doing so. Yes. Yeah. So I think that, for example, I'll just give you one example. The Migrant Rights Alliance here in Ireland have produced a report explaining kind of some of the situations that are being found in these kind of industry plants and the problems people are having when they do air grievances. So I think that Judith Butler, philosopher and professor, who I would often draw on for some of these things, talks about how when anyone wants to resist, when anyone wants to speak, one needs a basic infrastructure, a basic ground from which we can speak. Yeah. And it can be quite basic in terms of one needs a basic level of income. One needs to be able to feed oneself and house oneself before resistance becomes something we can even think about doing, you know? Sure. And I think that's the case in whistleblowing, as in other aspects of defending one's rights more generally.
Yeah. I've been studying psychoanalysis for many, many years and groups and individuals and working as a psychotherapist and as a coach. And I'm still... bewildered is the wrong word, but I amazed really by the levels of defense mechanisms and disassociation in individuals and in groups. I was coaching a person in the financial sector following the financial collapse, and the person's ability to disassociate from their actions was quite striking. And you notice this in many individuals you're working with as a coach or as a therapist. Our ability to sort of go into denial, but also organizations have that capacity too. There can be a culture of a silent organization, and people actually disassociate from what's really going on. I mean, we see it in kind of the fake news and how people follow what they want to believe at the moment. Do you see that in the organizations, that when a whistleblower blows, that there's actually kind of a denial going on, that this is not really happening in their organization? Have you noticed that pattern?
Yeah, I think that we can dissociate in lots of different areas of life. And that's one of the capacities I think humans have, isn't it? In order to defend some sort of coherence in our ego against particularly traumatic events. But I think the really interesting thing, because I study organizations, is organizations offer all sorts of ways in which you can do that. Obviously, Hannah Arendt and her study of the Eichmann trials, and then Zygmunt Bauman's follow-up on this about exactly what it is to work in an organization and be able to detach yourself from the ultimate impact of the job that you're doing. And I think, as Arendt describes Eichmann, she went to those trials thinking, let's figure out now what is driving these terrible actions. And her realization was, he's just actually a really good bureaucrat. He seems quite mild-mannered. You know, he seems like a family man. He seems like quite a calm individual, but he was really focused on doing the job well. And so the thing about organizations is, when they operate at scale, there's lots of different levels that come into play and that separate us from the ultimate impact of our actions. In other words, if we're involved in processes that ultimately create, you know, horrendous impacts for people, those impacts are not always available to us. They're not always obvious to us. We can kind of pretend. There's enough layers that enable us to deny it. We can, as I think Isabel Bauman would talk about, we can just be a cog in the wheel. We can just be our day job. And so organizations offer us these special ways of dissociation. And that's one of them. Emmanuel Levinas also talks about that ethics comes from the face of the other. So to be in the presence of somebody face to face, or, you know, I'm talking to you Zoom to Zoom, for example, means that there's a sort of a compulsion to be ethical in that way. And feminist theorists have talked about that also. But organizations, again, create these layers, create these internal walls that mean that face-to-face interaction is not always available or possible. Or you could go through 20 years in an organization. And we often see that in big bureaucracies, for example, maybe state bureaucracies that are ultimately there to maybe provide health services or to provide education services. But they're so large that individuals in them are not really in tune with the ultimate impact of those. And so I think the interesting thing is, I'm not sure we give organizations enough credit or we understand that the ethical implications that these apparently benign structures have. Yeah. We tend to think of organizations as these kind of benign, you know, anodyne things that don't have a particular ethic in and of themselves, but they absolutely do. And I think the last century has really shown us that.
I think that's really, really useful. I mean, Menzies Lyth's work, the psychoanalyst from the Tavistock in the 1950s, studied nursing and studied the defenses, the defense mechanisms of an organization, you know, how it structures a nurse so they get support through the structures of the organization to defend them against the anxiety of facing death and facing loss. And it was through the hierarchies and through the uniforms and through disassociating from the patient through different structures. And that goes on for unconsciously and consciously, where power plays a part, where people actually plan organizations in a way so that this happens for certain reasons, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure. And I think one of the things is this idea that organizations have to defend against, I mean, you know, life is inevitably a little bit chaotic and it doesn't happen in a planned, controlled, systemic way, that our inner lives do not happen in that way. But the world outside us doesn't happen. But there's a sort of a fantasy of control within organizations that we can maybe trace back to, you know, Max Weber was very clear on this around the ethic of rationality and, well, at least in some cases, instrumental rationality rather than substantive or actual rationality. But there's this kind of rationality that plays out in organizations that almost promises control over chaos. And that's a fantasy. And I think it's that that gets defended against in many cases. And that defense can come out in all sorts of ugly and destructive ways. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think another thing people often miss is we work in organizations and organizations work in us. And David Armstrong's work, his organization in the mind, talks a lot about this. I'm hoping to talk to David in a podcast soon. But his work is, he does work with organizations in the mind, not just kind of the image of an organization or the metaphor of the organization we carry in us, but how the actually organization imprints itself on us. So it's ethics, it's systems actually become internalized as part of us. And we carry around this organization and it acts on our ego. It can make us feel important. It can make us feel diminished. It can do many things to us. But how each of us kind of engages with an organization is a fascinating psychosocial dynamic, isn't it?
It is. And I'm glad you mentioned that. I find also Yanis Gabriel's work on this really, really helpful for me to think about. One of the things that I came across, and to your point, in the book I was writing, was that from the perspective of whistleblowers, obviously Fred Alford and others had talked about the way in which organizations can blame and scapegoat and vilify and defend their boundaries in that. But one of the things from interviewing people I was finding was, even when they go outside the organization, maybe they've lost their job, you know, they're no longer an employee, and yet they still find themselves blacklisted in their career or perhaps targeted in the media. Or perhaps, you know, even in some cases, I remember one woman, she was working in a bank and a lot of people in the neighborhood had their savings with this bank. And she felt compelled to speak up initially on behalf of a colleague. And so this made it into the press, onto TV, into the newspapers. And she was targeted for really negative reactions by her neighbors. So almost like society was taking on the work of the organization by almost carrying on the stigmatization and isolation of these individual whistleblowers who, again, had spoken out in the public interest. There was no question about that. But, well, there, you know, there was maybe some ambiguity if you had your savings in the bank. But I mean, this bank was clearly corrupt and ended up going bankrupt. So nobody won in that case. But the point that I'm trying to make is, as you said, if individuals do carry these organizational structures, I wonder, you know, do we even need to be working in an organization to have that strong presence of the organization in our minds, if that makes sense? Or have we, and this would be again back to Weber, have we come out of the last 100 years and more of rational thinking, of rules? Do organizations actually structure our thinking even outside of organizations more than we realize? Have we become an organized society? You know, is organization at the heart of how we think? And I know, I think it's Marcuse, and a number of others have kind of described that, but I wonder, do we sort of realize that? Is that actually sort of as powerful?
I think it's really lacked. And when I moved from psychotherapy into organizational studies and leadership studies and working at Lancaster University doing my PhD research, I remember being really shocked, and I still talk about this in my teachings and my courses, about how much of the organizational studies were intra-organizational. So you get your Harvard Business School case studies, and there was a real disassociation between organization and society. And I think this interplay is absolutely vital. This interplay between the organization does affect society, society does affect organizations. So depending on which culture you live, if you live in Japan, it's going to be different from New York, which is going to be different from Mississippi, which is going to be, but the way society and cultures form themselves and what happens. So if you're a whistleblower in an organization and you go out into your town, I guess it depends on, if you're working for Cadbury's in Birmingham 100 years ago, Cadbury's was a Quaker firm, and that had a massive impact on society around it. It was it had a lot of control and influence around society around it. It banned pubs in the area, it didn't like drinking, and it had codes of behavior, etc. But I think that still happens today, and we carry these organizations around in our minds and in ourselves, not just when we work in them, but like you talked about Amazon before, I think a lot of us carry Amazon around in us in different ways. You know, we have an idea of what it is. So if there's a whistleblower from Amazon, we will have a reaction to that, even though we're not part of that organization.
Well, that's true. That's really interesting. And I think, so another person working in this area, Mark Stein, describes how people's visceral and often really negative reaction to whistleblowers is because there may be some sort of trace of an idealized ethical self that has since, as we grow up, there's so many compromises that individuals make. Not everyone stays in the sort of the, you know, idealistic ethical way they might have envisaged for themselves as a 10-year-old. And so a whistleblower who speaks up, who really relinquishes a lot in order to follow their principle, can trigger all sorts of negative reactions because they represent what Stein calls this lost good self, you know, this.
Yeah.
And so all sorts of dynamics going on there. And again, I suppose back to a lot of the way in which these things are talked about, organizations more generally tend not to maybe pay attention as much to those aspects, for sure.
No, that's really, really helpful. Kate, this has been a fascinating discussion. We're coming to an end. As you may be aware, I ask my guests a question at the end of the podcast. What advice can you give to the audience around how to live a good life and how to create a good society based on your work and your thinking?
Thanks, Simon. It's a big question.
Big one.
I think we can't overestimate the capacity for organizations to create anxiety. This is to people who are working from home, to coaches as well as managers, as well as employees, and obviously people who speak out, that there's elements of organizations that do contribute to that. So to be aware of that, at least maybe some sort of kind of ability to care for the self and act accordingly. In other words, it's not you, it's the organization.
Yeah, very important. Kate, it's been really, really great talking to you. Thank you for your wisdom and your sharing.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, Simon@analyticnetwork.com.